Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And welcome aboard, and thank you very much for joining us here for another edition of Midrats. And as a reminder to those that are joining us live, make sure and scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find the chat room, where you can roll in with some of the usual suspects. And if you have some observations during the course of the show that you would like to share, or if there is a question you would like for us to direct to our guest, because it doesn't seem that we're heading quite in the direction you'd like us to, or you just have a flash of brilliance, please go ahead and put that in the chat room, and we would love to steal your good questions and claim them as our own. And if you have to hop off halfway through the show and you want to catch up on what you missed, or you want to catch up on some shows that you have missed before, best thing you do is go ahead and head on over to iTunes and subscribe to the free podcast there or over at Stitcher. And, of course, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio. But for now, let's go ahead and get on with the show. As we outlined in some of the pre-show advertisements, back in the mid-30s, a lot of people, that's their first introduction to seeing what modern mass communication in the right hands with the right people can really be done to influence a local population, to influence neighbors, to set a tone, to set a mood, to recruit people to your cause, or to intimidate others from opposing you. And what we've seen in the last quarter century is something that was just as rapid of a change back in the 1930s when it came to radio and eventually television, the distribution of movies, and that is Moore's Law working on the ability to spread digital, visual, and voice communications worldwide almost instantaneously. And that has really changed the way that not only we communicate with our own people, but also how our opponents communicate their message and try to blunt what we consider our priorities and our messages that we want to go. And what we want to explore today is how radical extremists are using modern technology, especially in the visual arena, to advance their goals, talk about who their audiences are, and perhaps come up with a few ideas that we could grab hold of to help counter it. And we're going to use as a starting point today a few pieces of work that our guests have published recently, and we're going to have, for the full hour, an opportunity not just to address those specific articles, but also additional issues as they arise. And you can find links to those over at the show page. But as our guest today is Strategic Studies Institute and U.S. Army War College Press publication, Visual Propaganda and Extremism in the Online Environment, also Small Wars Journals, ISIS and the Hollywood Visual Style. And our guests are going to be Corey E. Dauber, Professor of Communications at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And also with her will be Mark Robinson, also from UNC Chapel Hill, the Director of Multimedia Laboratory there. Welcome aboard, and thank you for coming on Midrats.
Thank you for having us.
Glad to be here.
And I wanted to just as kind of a scene setter is for our listeners, because this is kind of a non-traditional part of this, not just an actual war that's going on, but also a war on ideas and looking for people who are on the fence or maybe on one side you want to bring over to the other. And if you could just outline for a bit, Corey and Mark, how did a communications professor and a director of a multimedia lab at UNC Chapel Hill find themselves trying to help us figure out and get inside of the mind of radical extremists and their activities online?
So for me, as somebody in communications, we would think about the terrorist act as a communicative use of violence. My initial interest in Al-Qaeda was the way they were gaming the press, the professional press. But more and more, as time went on, they were really doing, if you want to think of it this way, they were doing their own press, their own products, and putting them on the web as the web advanced and as the technology advanced to allow them to do it. But to study that, to look at their production and their use of the internet, as somebody who was trained as a rhetoric professor, I really didn't have the background or the skill to do that on my own. And so that's when I began more and more annoying Mark in his office, because that's really his background and his training. So my interest in what I began to pull him into was the way the compositional elements of video have rhetorical force and rhetorical power. And then I guess that is his piece of it.
Yeah. I got suckered in a great way. It's a chance to help, and what I've been doing for a very long time is analysis of media. So I got into communication from the angle of the technical. So working with internet videos, compression, image analysis, those kinds of things.
Well, let's go. Let's talk a little bit about what these I'm going to call them internet jihadists, or the people who are using the internet and these sophisticated, seemingly more and more sophisticated techniques to get their message across. I think somebody described this as a war of wills, and that propaganda and images are the tools that they're using. Can you kind of describe for us, Corey, how this has progressed from the early days of Al-Qaeda and to where we see ISIS today, and you know, in like 2 seconds?
So if you go back, let's say, to 2006, Al-Qaeda at that point was years ahead of any other group that was integrating video into their web presence, which was pretty much every jihadist group. But they stayed stagnant for a number of years, and rapidly other groups began to push past what Al-Qaeda was doing. ISIS, and now the Islamic State, though, is clearly a generation ahead of all of these other groups. So if you look at them pretty much along any measure that you would use to assess video at a technical, compositional level, I think both of us would make the same argument, that they are just further ahead than any group that we've seen ever before on posting videos on the internet. Did that answer the question?
Yeah, I think so. Mark, let me ask you. I mean, did you look backward as you got into this at what Al-Qaeda was up to, and then as you've looked forward, how do you see the increase in their capabilities to get their message across?
What attracted me originally about Al-Qaeda was it was an interesting sort of radicalized style in terms of how it was shot, and completely unprofessional, so easily dismissed by most audience because it didn't fulfill any of the normal cultural needs that we expect that kind of media to fulfill. Now, as far as ISIS, as Dr. Dauber just said, they're moving towards consciously manipulating those cultural cues, that is to say, quality or craft in certain areas. And in doing so, they're moving their language to be more convincing. So analyzing that and trying to figure out a way to stop it seems pertinent this day.
Their visual language.
That's correct.
And what I find interesting about this is since 9/11, there's been an ongoing, and we're still having to do it every day almost, ongoing education of people of the nature of radical extremism today. There is a certain habit to underestimate them and to talk down to them as if you have a bunch of ignorant goat herds running around who, you know, can't read and are mind-numb robots. But in actuality, radicalism today is led, and in many places, their tactical-level people are engineers, doctors, professors, and other professionals, many of them educated in the West. They are sophisticated. They are smart. And we underestimate them at our own peril. And as you're outlining there a bit, they've started to get more and more sophisticated in how they are utilizing technology to communicate. And for the listener that may not be following it much in detail, and they're looking for a benchmark, what type of organization in the civilian world they might be familiar with would you think that the major radical extremist organizations, where they are operating at on their ability to produce good quality, viable product that pushes their message to the audience that they wish it to?
So what kind of professional group is putting out videos of equal quality to ISIS? Is that what you're asking us to assess?
Correct. You know, some type of civilian organization or company that they might be familiar with that they could use as a benchmark.
So if they weren't producing videos for ISIS, they would be working for
X.
Correct.
Well, I hate to break it down to actual videos, but I think maybe I can. Everybody's probably familiar with a local advertisement that airs as a sponsor maybe to a more local channel. For instance, a local car company who has the guy who owns the car lot comes on. He's sponsoring a movie that plays on television. That level is about the level at which ISIS is moving into. And they have already moved past that level with regards to things like their intros, their special effects intros. So in order to make a psychological claim on each thing that they are backing or producing, they have certain intros that they're adding in, and those have their icons, it has sound effects. It's produced in a program called After Effects, but the point is that they are relatively sophisticated, sometimes robbing directly, as Dr. Dobbers pointed out before, from people like maybe BBC News. So the moniker, I'm talking about the actual effect that runs between shows to tell you that, hey, we're back on air and this is what's going on. So the big red sphere that rotates. I don't know if that's enough information, but they're starting to move into that territory in terms of their effects and their controlled studio work. And then their field work is still quite amateur, but far more sophisticated than it used to. They're going out consciously making choices before they shoot a video. For instance, we need to shoot with two cameras instead of one. Well, most people are probably familiar with one camera. Maybe they filmed their own, you know, family reunion that way. But these people are actually making a decision before they go out and create a scene that they're going to script it. They're going to have camera angles. They're going to use some tools. For instance, they might use a crane, or we've seen some basic Steadicam work, that kind of thing.
Well, which kind of raises the issue as they've gotten more sophisticated in their presentation, the fundamentals. Let me ask it this way: the fundamentals of what they're trying to do, the asymmetric type of warfare they're waging, has that been modified too, or is this just a more sophisticated, slightly more sophisticated way of presenting, trying to shape the perceptions? I think in some of your work, Dr. Dobber, you said that, or other people have said that these terror attacks are media events. Is this continuing along those lines, or are they getting even more sophisticated in those events?
I think that they may have reached the point where the difference in where we're dealing, where all of it taken together, so the degree of sophistication in terms of the planning of the video, the way the computer graphics works, the planning of the event, all of it taken together, I just think all of it, the whole package, puts us into new territory. I don't know. You might not agree with that.
No, I do. I think this addresses part of the question you're asking, which is, they move from a violent scenario, whether that be ones that are atrocities, or even if you go back to Al Qaeda, all you're seeing really are people shooting with a very shaky cam, or bombs blowing up, IEDs, et cetera. And now they're making addresses to issues like family, culture, infrastructure for the Islamic State. They're focusing on a population which is far broader than the hyper-radicalized, hyper-violent extremists, and instead looking for people who are on the cusp, who want a place, want a home, and they're trying to present that argument now.
And Mark, that folds right into the question I wanted to bring up is their push to use the visual medium. Is a lot of this aimed towards an attempt to reach as broad of an audience as possible, because they're not just focused on the local Arabic dialect that they're trying to draw from, but it really is a global campaign, and there's a lot of language barriers to overcome. How much do you see in their work where they acknowledge the language challenge for a global audience? And besides Arabic, are there other languages that they make a dedicated effort to make sure that their visual information has text or narration that goes with it in other languages that is a target audience for?
They are pushing out videos in that are either in multiple languages, so not just Arabic, but Russian, Dutch, German, French, English, or are subtitled in those languages. But it's just also the case that they are pushing out videos where there's no narration per se, right? So there's no need to subtitle or worry about translation, because it's the visuals that are carrying the freight of the argument, basically.
Yeah, they're often letting the sort of a meta-ideologic argument carry forth and not have to actually have people talking. Just having the proximity, or having something like a religious chant in the background, we don't need to know what it says, but we know how and what it is saying, if that makes sense. We're familiar, even if we don't speak Arabic, we're familiar with the concept of that and what it means. And because we're comfortable with the meaning, we don't need the translation, and therefore any image they put with it is augmented by that acoustic information. It's like it would be analogous in my book to a country's national anthem being played while you watched people parade by the square.
Well, is part of that a... I'm getting mixed messages, and probably that's maybe their intent. But we see one in the article, ISIS and the Family Man. Dr. Dauber, you pointed out that they're, and Mark, I think you just said this too, they're putting out these images of men with their children, they're in playgrounds, and they're talking about how nice it is to be in a place where Sharia law is the only law that applies. There's no confusion. It's pure. And then we get these other videos. I mean, is that directed at one audience, the people they want to recruit? And then the other videos were, and I don't know how many we've seen recently, but, they're beheading somebody, or they're still kind of combat or post-combat imagery. Are there two different groups they're appealing to? Is this part of the problem? I'm having trying to sort out where these folks are going with some of their work.
I think there's just multiple buckets of narratives. Charlie Winner, who has written on this, makes the argument that there's six discrete categories of narratives. And I think part of the problem has been that we're always talking about needing a counter-narrative, and that's where we in the West have been missing the boat. A counter-narrative is not going to cut it, because they have multiple narratives.
Yeah, it gets back to one of your first questions, what attracts me to it, is that it's a they're providing a multivariable equation, and what we're trying to do is plug all those variables into one, and it isn't going to work. You need more than one equation to solve multivariables. So their war is being waged from their side by acknowledging that, for instance, younger people today are quite savvy in reconciling 2, 3, 5 narratives at the same time, you know, watching multiple videos at the same time, those kinds of things. Do they process it the same way, for instance, someone my age might process? Well, no, they have a different training, but it's still nonetheless a culturally valid one for them, and that's what they're addressing from the standpoint of ISIS, etc. They're recognizing that, and many of them, of course, are young enough to have that exposure themselves, and so that's the key in, if you will, that they're using.
And I guess that kind of begs the question: is to What are we doing to counter this line of operations on their part? Because, you know, one would think that with a lot of the policymakers and decision makers, 45 and up, so to speak, if they're looking to, you know, how do we operate and get information in, they might fall back to old habits, you know, the Radio Free Europe format, or how do we get articles in newspapers. But the information flow is going to different channels. It is not just the U.S., but perhaps nations in the area, Jordan, Egypt perhaps, maybe Morocco, some of the Europeans or even the Russians. Has anybody made a good effort to go into these channels that radical extremists such as the Islamic State and others are using and push that counter-narrative to any good effect?
An effort or a good effort? Because those are...
flesh out how you would define the two. That would be
interesting. Yeah. Well, so the State Department has had a program called Think Again, Turn Away that has involved fluent speakers on Twitter and has involved videos on YouTube. That I think I can speak for Mark when I say we think that they are, let's go with not so good. The relative quality compared to what the Islamic State has been pushing out, it ain't going to get it. They have recently created a regional center with some of the countries in the region. Now, we don't have the language skills to track that, so I can't speak to what's being pushed out of that center. I think the governments are starting to realize that they are not the best producer of these materials, and there seems to be a moment forming now when everybody is coming to the same conclusion, which is that if this is going to be solved, the way to do it is through peer-to-peer. So more and more people are turning to seeking out that age group to produce materials for that age group. And some of those materials have been pretty high quality. How they're being distributed, how they're being recognized, part of the problem has been that there's not a lot of empirical data to go on.
Well, let's. So in one of the pieces I read, it was discussed that propaganda confirms rather than, I guess, motivates. Is causative in people's making decisions. And when we talk about these ISIS and the family man sort of videos, and you know, there was some discussion in that article about not. The people, you know, we kept thinking that the appeal was to disaffected youth and various things, but it that may not be the case, as it turns out. And are we looking at a situation with some of these things that the ISIS and other folks are running is more like a car commercial, where once you've bought the Audi or Subaru, that all you notice from then on is the Audi and Subaru ads? Is it, and it confirms to you that you've made the right choice, or is there far more to it than a simple mind like mine can figure out in this area?
Well, I mean, I guess I think that the problem is that everybody keeps saying disaffected and alienated, disaffected and alienated, and we just don't have empirical proof of that, first. And second, it looks, I would argue, that they are going after much broader swaths of the available population, even if you buy the argument that they are attempting to recruit disaffected and alienated youth. I think there's pretty good evidence that they are going after broader cuts of the population. Now, it's not that it would be impossible to get empirical data on some of this. It's that, at least in the open source literature, as far as I can tell, nobody has paid the money to do the empirical research that it would take to solidify up some of this, some of these claims. So all I can tell you is it seems pretty clear that they are attempting to recruit more than simply, quote-unquote, disaffected and alienated.
The thing I would add to that would be, how many kids from the age of 14 to 22 do you know that say, I still don't know what I want to be when I grow up? If they're pitching to somebody, that's who they're pitching to. People who would say, I'm not sure what I want to do when I grow up.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty much everybody, right? So they're making this multivalent argument that is not just about hyper-radicalization from the start. That's not their objective. Their objective is to establish their own culture, absolute place where everybody can belong. The people that need to belong can belong.
It's a place where you can belong, but they are, in addition to that, I think, also pitching to people with families.
Yeah.
That we are building a good, decent place where you can create a good, decent home for your family. And if they were going after the disaffected and alienated only, they wouldn't be investing the effort to create those videos.
Yeah, that would explain their multi-channel approach, so to speak. And I wanted to kind of use a language that's probably familiar to a lot of our listeners, is in the military world, when it takes an opportunity to look at how it delivers messages, especially the Germans are especially good at this from a doctrine point of view, is you can break it generally into three different areas: psyops, info ops, and public affairs. And they have distinct audiences. And at least in the West, there's thou shall and thou shall not rules that apply to the three. And different people specialize in each. When you look at what the radical extremists online are producing, what percentage would you say their efforts break out into what in a Western military doctrine point of view would define as psyops, info ops, and public affairs?
So I think that they are all psyops. They play over, there's a substantial overlap for them between psyops and info ops, but they pretend as if it's all public affairs.
Well, I guess, when I was looking at this stuff, one of the things that struck me was how important these media, I want to say relations, but that's not really right, the communications, media communications was early on, and I think some of the articles indicated that the number two person in many of the organizations was a media person, and that, one of the pieces described the people being attacked in 2001 and running away with a rifle and a computer in their hand. But part of it was too that how sophisticated some of this stuff is. Are there well educated media experts on the staff of these staffs of some of these groups that are helping form the messages, just like an advertising agency would help that local car dealer make his pitch more successful?
Yes, but right now, we far outweigh that. So I guess I'm saying right now is a very good time for us to strike in terms of figuring out how we want to provide counter messaging. That is to say, the second that more sophisticated and more technically expert people are working, from their angle, the harder it's going to be to root them out of people's cultural memory. And that's going to be that's exactly what they're banking on, right? Terrorism is a way to instantaneously embed yourself into cultural memory. Thus, you know, 9/11, et cetera. So to me, yes, they have it. Dr. Dauber and I have noticed that upon a change in tactics, we noticed that quality was dropping for a while. It was clear that there was some sort of disturbance in their higher-end network, the people who actually know how to edit, for instance, the people who are actually capable of running studio sound, the people who are capable of their 3D effects. And we were able to plot quite successfully that, you know, something of significance had happened, whether that be an airstrike or something else, because that centralized work was being diffused, and we weren't seeing it for a relatively short amount of time. I'd say about, 5 months or something? And then it started to build back up. You know, our concern is that they might, they're either diversifying after a point like that. In other words, we force them to create more nexus of media teams, et cetera, and then they're going to realize that that's, you know, effective, or whether that was a preconceived strategy of theirs, I can't say. But the end result is if they put two and two together on that front, it's going to get harder and harder for anyone to diffuse that, their ability to communicate.
And, Mark, that kind of folds into something which I think we can address in an unclassified manner pretty well, is when you were you talked about how there's good quality product, there's a break, you got a lower quality product, and then the higher quality product came back later. That's post-production. That's people who really know their business. When they're not doing used car commercials or advertisements for the local Zippy Mart, they're doing this. And I'm curious, when it comes to post-production and their sophisticated ability to produce a quality product, how much of that is being done by them in theater, and how much of this post-production is being sent off to be done elsewhere in other countries? And to do that, you've got to use IP paths. And the U.S. military for quite a while has spent a lot of time and a lot of effort talking about information dominance, information warfare core, cyber war, cyber defense. Have we developed a good network where we take those that are monitoring and evaluating the type of propaganda that requires high bandwidth to move around, and especially to do quality post-production, to marry that up with the people that are trying to get a handle on how the enemy is using modern IP-based technology, and to get our cyber war areas we've invested so much money in to be able to perhaps affect that and move things, if nothing else, like you mentioned before, more periods of lower quality to at least mitigate their ability to communicate and recruit additional support.
I don't know that we would be able to assess that. I mean, that it seems to me from our end is kind of a black box, right? So we can look at a video and give you a sense of what the quality is, but where the post-production was done, I don't know that we can tell that from looking at it.
Only through, forensics would be the only way to actually tell strategic areas, et cetera, image analysis and whatnot. But I would assume that the United States has teams of people.
But we're not those guys.
That's not, we don't have exposure to that military intricacies so that we could make that analysis. We certainly would be happy, joining in and helping in any way we can with regards to that. And I think that's part of your question, if I understood it, and that is, is there a way to, or is there enough, I think was the word you used, maybe to cooperation between the higher end post-production people or analytic people and the government? Well, I don't know the answer because I'm not currently engaged enough with that, but A, I would hope so, and B, if not, there are certainly people like us that would be more than willing to do more. So I'm not sure that's an answer you're looking for.
It is in a way because, you know, when you look at this problem, you have the, to use simple terms, in many ways, effective communication, whether it's the spoken word, the written word, or visually, it's art. It really is. It requires somebody that has
a keen... Yeah, we have a hard time relating that to... I'm sorry to interrupt.
No.
It's exciting to hear you say that because one of the things that started us going was a conversation we had about this being highly effective and ugly art. Ugly not meaning bad. Ugly just meaning something which you want to turn your face from. But...
That's the same thing, you know, Leni Riefenstahl. I mean, her... If you ignore what her videos were about, especially for her time in the 1930s and the technology she had, incredible artistry there, incredible production.
That's right.
You have to respect her professionalism. And kind of what my question was bouncing around is you have people who really who know their business well of how people communicate, the different paths, the methods, what's good, what's bad, what takes a professional, what's a rank amateur, what's somebody who's learning. That uses one side of the brain. The other side of the brain is people who probably aren't that artistic, but they know their ones and zeros. They, you know, somebody can tell them that a certain production or a certain visual medium was used here, vice another one's used here. They can go in there and break that down into ones and zeros and perhaps look for fingerprints and to be able to perhaps flesh out a little more information on how these things are being done. And many times that we see that you have one side of the brain which is really focused and working in a particular area, you know, whether you want to call it multidisciplinary approach, if you want to use lots of syllables. And if you just had the other specialty, the other side of the brain that could come in and work in conjunction and balance off ideas, the sum is greater than the individual parts. And I was just curious as you've gone and you've worked on, you know, Small Wars Journal, working with the Army War College, you have a lot of the technical analysis brain. Whether you've had an opportunity or you've seen where people have taken a multidisciplinary approach to kind of peel the onion on how this is being done and to better understand it, not just from the artistic point of view, but seeing what that art can tell you about the technology, and that may be able to lead to understanding where you can have the high quality go to the low quality, so to speak.
Well, see, that's why I need to be able to work with Mark, because he's a maker. He's made his own artistic work, but understands all the computer stuff. You know, I kind of know how to turn the computer on a little bit, and I think he works with me mostly because it's entertaining to him the periodic times I crash the computer for things he thinks is hilarious. So he combines the artistic piece with the coding piece. And I understand all of the pieces about rhetoric. What does it mean that symbols are persuasive, and how do you put that together? And so I think we are the multidisciplinary piece that you're talking about, if I understand where your question was headed.
Well, I think Sal's point raises another issue, which is discussed in some of the work, too, which is... And maybe as this period has gone on from whenever this started over the last 10 years, more sophisticated and readily available computer programs exist, which are and what is the effect of that? I mean, we've got lower cost computers, we've got the many portable things. Go ahead.
Cameras,
right. Yeah, everybody's got a cell phone camera now, and they're getting better and better. My question is, you know, as we go through this where they're getting stuff off the shelf, it doesn't cost much, do they do away with what were traditionally media centers that they had, or can you tell that from what you're seeing? I mean, how much of this is an individual sitting down, like I'm sitting at my computer right now, playing with his programs, and how much of this is some more sophisticated center where several people might work on some of these rather elaborate videos?
Well, all of it is being democratized, right? And it's not, it's not simply cell phone cameras. I mean, when you look at the lab that Mark has for the kids and what we're able to buy now for the students who come in to learn media production at UNC, it's a completely different ballgame than it was even 10 years ago, because close to professional quality cameras simply don't cost what they used to. We can provide for the students just a different experience than we could 10, 15 years ago. Now, that said, and same thing for the software, that said, it's still the case that the better the stuff, the more you need training to be able to produce a decent product on the back end of it. And that's what it is we're trying to assess when we look at these videos. Now, what we saw happen at the end of last year was that this relatively centralized system that they had suddenly decentralized, so that they were pushing out, and they all of a sudden were, the videos were coming from multiple places, and that's when the quality seemed to crater. And now the quality is starting to come back up, and that's why the narrative that Mark gave you, that we now think something different happened from what we originally thought when we saw that happen at first.
Almost like a rebuilding an industry and infrastructure after it was taken out. And, it does show they are a learning institution.
Exactly. That's exactly what we think happened. Now, whether they did it in advance of losing a building or whether they did it in response to losing a building, that's a black box to us. We can speculate on reasons. We can only tell you what we saw happen.
The art aspect is still missing from a high art, like capital A sort of world. And certainly that high-end production isn't even close to what they're doing right now. I'm not sure whether, well, I won't speculate on anything other than the fact that if they continue to be successful in recruiting people, it is inevitable that they will receive artists who are also capable of technology.
Correct, and they have shown a good habit of being able to channel people to the specialties they came in. And Mark, I believe you brought this up earlier, and I wanted to back it up a bit, because part of it is the production, but when you reach this product, you have to find a path in order to a channel, in order to distribute it to your customer. And without going into the domestic political parts of it, but since the new year, Twitter has set up a trust and safety council that when you look on who's on it, it's really focused on various domestic socio-political agenda-defined organizations, policing who's doing what on Twitter. And it kind of begs the question, and I know it was for a while, I don't know whether it's changed either more or less, but specifically Twitter, how much is that used as a channel to distribute or to point people in the direction of some of the products that they're producing? And are you aware of anything that Twitter or similar organizations have done that's comparable to this domestic trust and safety council that gives the ability of people on Twitter to help police Twitter users and the product they're producing that might be promoting violence, murder, et cetera, and so forth?
So Twitter has, in waves, periodically shut down ISIS-associated accounts. And there is some very elegant work looking at those accounts, at the way they have used Twitter, at the way they have gamed Twitter. And I would point people in particular to the work of J.M. Berger, and he and some other people have really used sort of big data approaches to look at the implications of that. Now, whether they're, how they choose which accounts to shut down, I'm not sure, and I can't really speak to that. Now, the argument has been made of late that they're really starting to see impacts in terms of the benefit that ISIS gets off of Twitter, that they're really starting to be hurt by these waves of account shutdowns. The other thing that I've seen recently, George Washington University has a program on extremism, and they just in the last 2 weeks maybe have started a program asking people, looking for accounts that are associated with extremism, and asking people to help them push Twitter to shut those accounts down. So when they find one of these accounts, they highlight it, they ask Twitter to shut it down, and they ask their followers to retweet that request.
As part of your question, too, was this, are we seeing them succeed with it? Was that part of the question, or...?
Yeah, I think that was part of the question.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, yes, I would say that's the reason they're feeling the damage when a successful campaign is knocking out their account. It is any movement towards those methods that age group are going to use and use fluently certainly are going to be effective. It's analogous to leaflet dropping. World War II. We couldn't drop film very easily. We could show it in big public houses, but there wasn't really any way to push it across the network. Obviously now they have the ability to do that quite instantaneously. So that, I would say those are huge threats.
Well, it also brings up the issue of branding and logos. As ISIS and it gets more sophisticated, I'm going to get to your Hollywood approach to what they've been doing. But how important is it to ISIS in particular that they establish a brand that will help other, like say Boko Haram in Nigeria want to become part of their organization, or at least adopt some of their techniques? Is this a key part of what they're doing?
I would say that was the point a while back that we were talking about the effect, the high quality of the 3D graphics that are coming in at the beginning. They're effectively trying to establish a brand there, and what we see now is that if you just look at the image type and how it's laid out and the way those effects are used, you'll see them in all the other organizations mirroring exactly the layout, just a slightly different logo.
Yeah, I mean the branding that was accomplished with the caliphate, right, the graphics that Mark is talking about is sort of the visual way to grab hold of the benefit that they got from that message.
One of the things that kind of piqued an interest of mine is I get a kick out of, I may be oversharing here, but I get a kick out of fan films. There are people that, whether it's Star Trek, Star Wars, The Walking Dead, Leave It to Beaver, I don't know, people who like various movies, but they write fan fiction, and some people are now doing fan videos, some of which are actually not too shabby. And in the article that y'all had published in Small Wars Journal, you started off one of the paragraphs, Corey, with many of the videos examined say, quote, on behalf of, unquote, are dedicated to, .. and goes on to explain that. And I was curious whether we have seen any trends recently of these types of videos that are distributed that are, no kidding, lack of a better phrase, sanctioned and produced by the Islamic State, or those that were created and distributed by Lone Wolf or fan films or fan productions that weren't officially sanctioned, but somebody said, you know, we talk about people who are radicalized via the internet, radicalized from a distance. So you have some guy who is sitting there in Toronto or Santa Clara or Amsterdam, spends some time, produces a video, and puts it out there that kind of looks like or has a feel of something that would have been a dedicated and produced production of the Islamic State, but was just done by supporters on the outside.
Man, that account, I still don't know what the deal was with that account. It's not, those videos never worked in the same way that Al-Qaeda stuff did, right? Al-Qaeda was kind of an internet free-for-all, where people were grabbing down footage and, you know, splicing and dicing and coming up with whatever kind of videos they liked. It has never been like that with either ISIS or the Islamic State. There is much more of a centralized visual aesthetic. And so, you know, that account has always kind of perplexed me as a result of that, because you just don't, those videos have never been in any way out of sync with the style, the nothing about them looked in any way unlike something coming out of the Home Office, except for that opening graphic that just said on behalf of. And there's no way, you know, YouTube does not pick up the phone, so there's no way to get a hold of a human being at YouTube to try and get any information about the account other than what I put in that paper. So I don't know. It's an outlier. I don't know what to make of that. I've never quite known what to make of that account, other than to say, for whatever reason, people do not do their own sort of homebrew videos with ISIS, now the Islamic State, the way they always have with Al-Qaeda. And I don't know whether that's because they're simply being taken down as soon as they go up, whether people are scared to mess with ISIS stuff, or what the deal is. But there is a centralized visual aesthetic, and nobody messes with it. And that was never the case with Al-Qaeda ever that we saw.
Yeah, I mean, one potential read of what Dr. Dauber just said is that there's a quality control department with ISIS, and they're actually contacting people who they feel are allies spreading their message, and if they see one of those videos, they're sending a note personal from the top that says, hey, we appreciate your efforts, but we need it to follow certain prerequisites, and yours doesn't meet that. Would you mind taking it down? I mean, that's sort of a horrifying idea, but I wouldn't put it
that's
past.
One heck of a compliance department.
Yeah. There's clearly something going on that is
controlling.
Very different from the way things work with Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
Well, that leads right into that discussion at the end of your Hollywood visual style thing that I want to talk about, which is that I think you say ISIS visual materials aren't just slick or sophisticated, they're making very specific choices that contribute to a very specific visual style. And I guess that leads my question, which is that part of this quality control effort that they have? And when you talk about this specific style, I think you say somewhere in that article that every single frame in their videos, the good videos, are carefully chosen and selected for a purpose. And can you kind of discuss that and a little bit about the importance of that for those of us who are looking at how to deal with these guys?
Sure. I'll start. I know that Dr. Dauber has something far wiser than what I'm going to say. But if you're watching any sort of media, let's just take a film, and it's trying to sell itself as a Hollywood film. So not these, but... And throughout it, the sound kind of ditches in and out. Or even the layperson realizes that there's sort of these weird gaps between the videos, or it doesn't really connect. Continuity isn't good. We see microphones and things like that. All those elements are elements of craft. Craft, the idea is that in order to suspend reality, we don't want to inspect things intellectually. What we want to do is experience things. So the closer you move towards creating a product that doesn't allow someone to automatically or as a knee-jerk reaction take a step back from their suspended reality and say, oh, wait, I can analyze that. The continuity wasn't good. The microphone was showing it's not supposed to be. Color balance wasn't done. All those things. Whatever it is and whatever level you can pick up on, there are two things that are important about that. One, even the most lay person in terms of video consumption or image consumption understands those things. They just may not have the words for them yet, but they can actually identify them. And then the other is, obviously, the closer that ISIS is moving towards those kinds of accounts, the more seamless the message will be, and therefore there'll be fewer interruptions. The fewer interruptions, the more continuous, again and again and again.
So the less you're thinking about the process of the video having been made, the better a product it is. Right? When you should not be thinking about how it was put together. You should just be absorbing the message from the perspective of the person who makes the video. And remember, we're not Intel guys, right? And we don't assess them from that perspective. We can only tell you about the quality of the video. And then what kind of speculation goes in after that is, you know, that's sort of not our piece of it.
Well, you may not be Intel guys. You may not be Intel guys, but the message that I get from these articles is rather chilling, and very eye-opening stuff for people who are looking at this for the first time from the outside. Sorry, Sal, jumped on you.
No. That's fine. That brought in again the discussion of the art of creating quality production, and is sophisticated, is dangerous for exactly the reasons you laid out, Corey, is the fact that when you're no longer, oh, look, there's the mic, you're not doing the blooper reel, but you're actually absorbing the message because you're not distracted by the blooper reel, it really becomes effective. And one thing that y'all also brought up a fair bit is the, lack of a better phrase, the visual aesthetic of their videos. And it really broke into the national, international conscious when, as the Islamic State started to take additional territory, is they did a visual propaganda version of shock and awe. Videos of things that people used to try to hide or pretend didn't happen, they brought out in a proud manner, mass executions, burning people in cages, selling young girls at slave markets, and we're proud of it, just numbing the senses of people, and even worse things that I just don't even want to mention about. And what I'm curious about, as we're coming up with just a few minutes left on the show, is in some ways that's dropped into the background. Maybe it's because everybody's become numb to it, or perhaps they've decided to go in a different direction. And what have y'all seen in that visual aesthetic, in that focused goals, whether it is the family videos recruiting people from Tunisia to Indonesia, what can we expect to see from a visual propaganda point of view from the Islamic State going forward based upon the moves they've made in the last few months?
So we're starting to look at videos that we are calling the day in the life that are very much about governance. So the day in the life of the traffic cop, the day in the life of the fire and rescue unit. My personal favorite is the day in the life of the food inspector, where they follow the guy from one store to another, and somebody gets busted because they've got food on the shelves, you know, post the sell-by date and the ticket gets written up, that kind of thing. And those videos have all kinds of implicit arguments going on, and there's just a lot going on in those, both in terms of the implicit arguments and also in terms of the way they're shot. And I think that's probably the next place that I want to go. I haven't actually talked to Mark about where we're going next, but that's my next interest, I guess.
The thing that's fascinating to me about their movement is they're going to continue to, they're a terrorist organization until they decide that they are no longer. They're going to continue to do the shock and awe videos. They're going to be, you know, awful and atrocious. The advantage to those is that it turns off a population who isn't interested in them and who doesn't want to do anything. So it creates a audience, an enormous audience, probably in the majority, who will say, you know, as a defense mechanism, I can't afford the luxury of watching these. Luxury meaning they've got free time, they don't want to spend it watching atrocity videos. And they'll dismiss the rest of it for that, which works to their advantage, because as long as a war is being waged, their identity is recognized, and if they can continue to sway people to their side, they can begin to form a more and more unified sense of self and state. You know, Al-Qaeda was, we desperately clamored as news agencies and as audience members to identify something that meant Al-Qaeda when people brought it up. Is there a person? Are there people? Oh, there's 52 people we need to be concerned with, or whatever it is, trying to form an identity. They're not so interested in having rock stars, although they definitely have their rock stars. They seem to be more interested in trying to sway people on a larger scale.
Wow. Let me. We're out of time, but I want to thank you both for taking the time to be on with us this afternoon and give you the chance to tell us and our audience what we can look for from you in the future, so that we can do more reading on this topic, about which I confess I knew very little before I started researching for this show, and which I find completely fascinating.
Thanks for having us.
Have you got some publications coming up or something else you'd like to talk about?
We're still sort of in the drafting phase of the next stuff, so I don't know if there's anything we're ready to pitch just yet.
Okay. Well, again, thanks a lot for taking the time to be on our show with us.
Well, thank you so much for inviting us.
Absolutely, Corey, Mike. I really enjoyed the topic. And when you're in a war of ideas, it's how you transmit those ideas is just so important. And I really appreciate the opportunity to share the work that you all have done with our listeners. And I wish you well in the new year.
Thank you.
And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for today's MidRats. Make sure and join us next week when our guest will be Captain C.C. Felker, USN, Professor of History at the United States Naval Academy, where we are going to discuss innovation during the interwar period of the 1920s and the 1930s. Until then, I hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go. It's a long way.